And good morning, Richard. Nice to have you in our studios again. Let me introduce Richard Fagan. 2 weeks ago, he was here talking about Antarctica and with some amazing information about snow and animals and sea life that surrounds that area. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce him again to those listeners who perhaps didn't hear that first episode. And this is Richard Fagan. He retired from as a professor at Stanford University to Lopez Island, came here full-time in 1993, and lives here with his wife, Deborah, who was also a librarian at Stanford. And Richard, how long were you at Stanford again?
Yeah, I was there for 35 years, 32 on the faculty, and 3 as a student.
And your fields were journalism and political science, right?
Correct.
Okay, so I'll introduce it the same way I did last time, except for now I don't have my sheet in front of me. This tell me the name of the program that we're...
This strange and wonderful world.
And the strange and wonderful world of Antarctica is what we're going to continue today. This is part 2 of a 2-part series, I believe.
Actually, we're going to do more.
Oh, we're going to do more. We're going to... This for the winter months here in January and February, we're going to visit Antarctica.
We might as well go where it's really cold.
Yeah, then we'll feel better about whatever's happening where we are. And the program this week is The Race to the Pole. We're going to talk about the human exploration of that part of the world, right?
Right, and we're going to talk about the beginnings of the real inland exploration of Antarctica for much of the 19th century. Various expeditions had been poking around the edge of the continent, and they were sealing and they were whaling, and they were there basically for commercial purposes, although there was some exploration. But certainly by the turn of the century, in Europe, and this meant in Norway, in Scotland to some extent, but particularly in England, there was just immense interest in getting to the South Pole. So the South Pole loomed as a goal, and it was felt that the nation that got to the pole would achieve a very significant geographical first, and it was a question of national honor and national pride, and this is really where our story begins.
Okay, and remind me, what year are we talking here?
Well, the story really starts at the very end of the 19th century when a Norwegian by the name of Raoul Amundsen, who had been born in 1872, actually wintered over in Antarctica, wintered on a ship. He was with a Belgian expedition, and that Belgian expedition was 1897 to 99. So the very, very end of the 19th century. And that wintering over in Antarctica, when the ship got embayed in the ice, trapped in the ice, and they lived on the ship with a little camp on the ice as well, led him into what was a relatively short but very dramatic life of exploration. Now, his next big accomplishment after wintering over was he led an expedition, Raoul Amundsen, a Norwegian, of course, to traverse the Northwest Passage in 1903. And people knew that there was some kind of a passage above Canada from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, but no one had ever made that trip from the Atlantic to the Pacific or from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And Amundsen did it in 1903. And this was very, very important for what he later did because he came in contact, intimate contact, during that trip with native peoples. And being a Norwegian, he knew how to ski because he was, like many Norwegian kids, practically born on skis. But his experience with the way the native peoples survived there with their dogs, with their animal skins, with the various forms of transport they had on sledges, drawn by dogs, of course, made a tremendous impression on him. And he was an open-minded person, and he said, this is the way to travel in cold places.
Wow. And that was new information for anyone that didn't live on ice.
Exactly. That wasn't the way they really did it in
right.
Norway, but this is the way the people who had been born and raised and survived there, this was part of their culture, and he learned from it, and he absorbed that. And he decided on the basis of this that he could get to the South Pole. So he organized an expedition to go to the South Pole. A little later on, we're going to meet Robert Falcon Scott, who was the Englishman who had the same idea, coming from a very different set of experiences. And so we call it the race to the pole, because as it evolved, it was really a race between Amundsen and Scott, the Norwegian and the Englishman, to see who could get to the pole first. And both of them understood it in those terms, that it mm-hmm. was, in fact, a race, that they were competing against each other, and that they were really the only two competitors. And I think
quite
it's probably
amazing.
I think it's better we talk about Amundsen first.
Okay.
And then we'll get back to
And
Scott.
Were they doing this at the same time?
Well, yes, they overlapped. And this was actually quite crucial, because Amundsen was holding this expedition fairly close to his chest, so to speak. He didn't want a lot of people to know about it. And he equipped himself in what I'm going to call the Eskimo way, for shorthand, which is to say, with dogs, with skins of various kinds for their clothing, with sledges, which were based on the northern Eskimo model of a sledge made out of wood. And could take the pounding of the ice, etc. And what he did, since he knew that Scott was interested and also on the way to the pole, he, Amundsen, waited until he was actually at sea going to Antarctica before he sprung it on Scott that he, Amundsen, was going for the pole. And he sent a telegram, very short, not particularly sweet, which said, beg to inform you, Fram was the name of his ship, Amundsen's ship,
mm-hmm.
beg to inform you, Fram preceding Antarctic, Amundsen. And this hit Scott like a bombshell, because Scott didn't think that he had any direct competition at the time. Now, Amundsen got to Antarctica on January 14th, 1911. So this is before the outbreak of the First World War.
And it's, again, the middle of summer there.
It's the middle of summer. Well, it's really the beginning. No, you're right. It's the middle of summer. And he landed on the Ross Ice Shelf. When we talked last time about ice shelves. The Ross Ice Shelf is the point that is closest to the pole. So if you take a look at the map of Antarctica and you say, where can I hit ice shelf, or land that will land me closest to the pole so I have the shortest possible distance to go, you choose the Ross Ice Shelf. Because from the edge of the shelf to the pole, it's only 800 miles.
Was any of that mapped then, though?
Inland, some of it was mapped, but not much.
How was it mapped, even? I don't...
Well, Scott and his people had mapped it, and other explorers had mapped it on previous expeditions. But one of the Ross Ice Shelf is quite broad across its base, where it meets the sea, the
mm-hmm.
open sea or
yeah.
the ice-packed sea, maybe 200 miles. So part of it was known, and Amundsen landed on a part of the Ross Ice Shelf that was not known. So it was not mapped.
So, but did he know that?
Oh, yes, he knew it.
He knew that it
wasn't mapped. And he landed there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So he wouldn't be in Scott's turf.
These navigators amaze me.
Well, of course, they had very accurate sextants and timepieces, so they could navigate quite accurately.
and had been able to for a long time.
Yeah, compass isn't particularly useful. You're too close to the south magnetic
to the poles,
pole, which is not at the South Pole.
Right.
So basically sextant And, of course, very, very accurate timepieces. Now,
I want to ask one other question that came to mind. So Amundsen built his sledges, as you call them, out of wood. What did they build their sledges out of in places they didn't have any trees?
Well, they used bone.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, from the large marine mammals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whale bones.
Yeah, whale bones, and even the elephant seals. Has bones that are big enough for that.
Sure.
And they lashed them with pieces of hide.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
His were built out of wood. And the way in which the trip to the pole, the rush for the pole, was planned is that you send out preliminary parties, and these parties set up depots, because one of the huge problems is that you simply cannot carry enough food and supplies to get there and to get back. I mean, if you're right on target, it's still 1,600 miles, and of course, it's unbelievably cold. You're exercising a tremendous amount. You're burning 5,000-6,000 calories a day.
Yeah.
So you need a lot of food.
It's like climbing a mountain.
Absolutely.
You send out these expeditions.
It's the same sort of metabolic
problem.
And so they laid out depots, this is Amundsen again, at 80 degrees south, 81 degrees south, and 82 degrees south. Each of those would be roughly 60 miles apart. Okay. And then on October 19th, they have already been there. They've wintered over once, because remember, they got there in January.
Yeah.
So they set out depots, and then they wintered over. And then very early in what would be the southern spring, this is October of 1911, they set out for the pole. And they had with them four sledges, which is what they call these sleds, carrying supplies, 52 dogs pulling these sledges, and four companions. So there were five in all.
Small.
Small, exactly.
And they've wintered over.
And they had already wintered over. That's right. Yeah, you pretty much have to, because you have to prepare the first season,
right,
then set out very early.
And what are they eating?
A main staple food was pemmican, which is a Native American food, which is made up of animal fat, animal fiber, and usually some kind of binder. But it could be just the animal fat rendered out and the animal fiber. We actually made, Deborah and I, actually made some pemmican to an old recipe. Took it on one of these trips so people could. Of course, it drove the vegetarians crazy. I mean, there's nothing more foul to a dedicated vegetarian than pemmican. It's the essence. Everything that they don't want to have anywhere near them. But we made it out of quite good beef, which had been dried, sort of jerked beef. And I forget, I think we put some kind of binder in, like whole oats, I'm not quite sure. And this rendered fat. I thought it was quite tasty. But anyway, that would be a staple food. And,
right. And would they kill, like, birds?
Is that part of the story? We'll get to that.
Okay. I'm ahead of the story.
Yeah. they were not sentimentalists.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Few of our ancestors were.
Yeah. And it means that they had not only the problem of feeding themselves, but they had the problem of feeding the dogs.
52 right. dogs.
Yeah, 52 dogs. And, of course, they killed seal meat and things like that. So they took along as much meat as they could carry. It's a balance between what you can carry and what you need. But their plan from the start, not being sentimentalists, was to kill and eat the dogs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
As the dogs were a wasting asset. So the dogs were killed as their... as the weight on the sledges was lightened and they didn't need all the dogs to pull, and the dogs were fed to the dogs. And, of course, the dogs were ravenous. They would eat anything. In fact, you had to keep them from eating the leather that was the harnesses and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, these are Siberian huskies. These guys, they're very close to wolves. So they actually arrived at the pole on December 14th. So they set out in October, so they were on the road, so to speak, till November and December. Well, roughly 60 days to get to the pole. And at that time, they had 16 dogs left.
Wow.
Yeah. And they were rather light on their load.
But they had to get all the way back.
But don't forget, you're going to the pole, you're going uphill.
Oh.
Right? You're climbing to 9,000.
That's why I remember that.
Yeah, you're climbing to 9,000 feet from sea level. Going back, you're going downhill.
So it's an easier slide.
Part of the way on what's called the polar plateau, which is not glacier, but just packed ice, could be rough, and then eventually onto glacier, and then finally onto the ice shelf itself and your home. And in fact, the first roughly 100-plus miles was over the ice shelf before they hit land. I mean, it didn't look any different when they hit land because they didn't see the land.
Which brings into question, okay, so they used the sextant to navigate on the surface. How did they get the topography of the land?
They didn't. It's by experiment.
So they didn't know they were going to climb that high.
Well, they knew they were going to have to climb. They didn't know how high, but they knew they were going to have to climb.
Okay.
Because Scott and some people had already been part of the way on an earlier trip.
Yeah.
So they knew they were going to have to climb, and they were expert on skis.
Yeah.
And, of course, they attached skins to the bottom of their skis so that they could climb.
Yeah, these were early cross-country.
Oh, yeah. They were expert skiers.
Yeah.
And, of course, the energy to ski with the dogs pulling, the energy requirement is much less than if you were walking.
Yeah.
So they got there, and it was actually rather uneventful. And they left a tent at the South Pole with a letter saying, you know, we were here at such and such a time. And they returned then, and they, going downhill, it only took them about 40 days to get back. 60 up, 40 back. Traveling light, stopping at these depots that they'd laid to get fresh supplies, etc. And with their skis, dogs, and the remaining, I think, two sledges at that point, still eating dogs, feeding dogs to dogs.
Sure.
They got back. And Amundsen wrote a book later, and in his classic laconic style, because it was sort of a no big deal, we did what we had to do, he wrote the following, which is pure Amundsen. He wrote, I may say that this is the greatest factor, the way in which the expedition is equipped, the way in which every difficulty is foreseen and precautions taken for meeting or avoiding those difficulties. Victory awaits him who has everything in order. Luck, people call it. And you can hear him shaking his head. Defeat is certain for him who has neglected to take the necessary precautions in time. This is called bad luck. This is a man who didn't believe in luck.
Right.
Good or bad. What
he
believed in.
Strategy and planning.
Strategy, everything right. No sentimentality. You do what has to be done. And if you do everything right, you will succeed. Which brings us, well, let me say what happened to this wonderful explorer. He continued to explore largely in the north. And by this time, airships had come, into existence. And he worked with an Italian explorer by the name of Nobili. And Nobili was an expert in lighter-than-air ships, powered dirigibles, early dirigibles. And Nobili, the Italian, disappeared on a trip and to the north, up near the North Pole. And Amundsen went to look for him in a conventional flying boat, in an amphibious airplane, and he disappeared in June 1928. So
they both disappeared.
He was still a relatively young man.
That's quite an interesting story to know.
Never found again. Never found.
One disappeared and the other disappeared looking.
Exactly. So that brings us to Robert Scott, the Englishman.
All right.
Now, Scott, and this is important, was a career naval officer. And the British Navy was the most traditional of very traditional services. Everything was done by hierarchy and in its way. And this...
Not such an open mind.
Not an open mind, no. A very interesting, intrepid, and a very literate man. Literate in the sense that he wrote beautifully, as we shall see in a few minutes. Anyway, he had a conventional naval career. When he started out, he wasn't thinking about polar exploration. Very different than Amundsen, who had cold countries on his list from the time he was a boy. Right. His mom didn't want him to do this, Amundsen. But Amundsen was a cold country guy and an explorer, really from the time he was a teenager. Scott was different. He was a conventional naval officer. And he was born, by the way, in 1886. So when he was really very young, he was the leader of a naval expedition called the Discovery Expedition. The Discovery was the name of the ship. It was a voyage of discovery, but the Discovery was the name of the ship. And he went down to Antarctica under Naval and Royal Geographical Society auspices with the idea of doing science in Antarctica, to find out about Antarctica. It wasn't a trip of exploration as much as it was a trip of science. Mm-hmm. And did a lot of science and spent a year on the polar plateau, which means that he was up about almost at least a third of the way to the pole. He was off the ice shelf and onto the polar plateau doing science. Now, they wintered over, of course, and he actually got south on this trip to 82 degrees south. Now, of course, the pole is at 90 degrees south, so you've got a good chunk of, you got 8 degrees, and each degree is 60 miles, so you have close to 500 miles left when you're at 82 south, 500 of the 800
right.
you have to go. Anyway, the ship was in bathe, the Discovery, was trapped in the ice, and it took two ships to come and rescue them and explosives to blast them out of the ice. So Scott had an experience of, you know, what this ice was like and how forbidding it could be. And Ernest Shackleton, whom we will meet probably next time, we don't have time this time, was with him. And a rivalry really developed between Shackleton and Scott. Shackleton got sick when they went up on the plateau, had to be sent home. It obviously rankled with Shackleton. Scott didn't appreciate the fact that one of his guys had gotten so sick, had to be sent home, etc. But we'll pick up part of that next time, probably. In any event, in 1910, so it's actually a little bit before Amundsen, Scott is off to Antarctica again, and this time he has the pole in mind. Still, there was a kind of envelope of science around the trip, but the idea is the pole. Wants to get to the pole, and it's as he's coming down that he gets this note, which I read earlier, from Amundsen saying, "I'm going to Antarctica." So now the race is really on, and Scott knows it's on. And he wrote at that time about his trip south. He said, "The main objective is to reach the South Pole and to secure for the British Empire the honor of this achievement." So now he's wrapped in the flag, and the nation is watching him. The nation is eventually aware that Amundsen and the race is on, and it's being followed as best you can follow it, of course, at this time, but by wireless, because they were able to wireless into New Zealand, because the Ross Ice Shelf is, if you were to take the international dateline, 180 degrees opposite, directly opposite Greenwich, England, mm-hmm. you were to take the dateline and extend it south, you would go right through the center of the Ross Ice Shelf. So they're in that part of the world, below New Zealand. So you could, by wireless, you could send it out to New Zealand, and from New Zealand it would hop, and it would eventually get back to the European continent. But Scott, unlike Amundsen, was prejudiced against dogs, although he took them. He thought dogs were...
But he didn't like them.
He didn't like them, and he thought that it was unsportsmanlike.
Okay.
That real men walked on their feet. They had skis, but they didn't know how to use them. They had dogs. They didn't know how to drive them. And they even brought ponies with them. Now, this is a little unrealistic. One of their team had seen ponies in Siberia, where there is a big hoofed pony called the Siberian pony, which is actually used on ice. So they thought that, and the British are more comfortable with
Sure.
With
they're more
horses,
familiar with horses. That's
horses,
their
right.
heritage.
Cavalry, right?
Right. Interesting.
So this is the Antarctic Cavalry.
Totally different expedition.
Yeah.
Even their motives, because, I mean, while certainly probably nationalism was a piece of Amundsen's, it was his boyhood vision and dream for it. It was his destiny, his personal destiny.
You're absolutely right. So he has these ponies down here. Now, there's a problem with ponies. They don't eat meat. And about the only thing you can get down there is meat. And meat is in abundance because of the seals and the penguins and things like that. But hay is not in abundance. So they had to bring hay with them to feed the ponies. And there are actually some wonderful, sort of sad, tragicomic photographs of them offloading bales of hay to feed the ponies down in Antarctica. The ponies did not do terribly well. They even bought a couple of motor sledges because by this time internal combustion engines, of course, existed. And Scott thought, well, we might be able to be very modern. We'd have motorized sledges.
Don't need those dogs.
And, of course, they weren't about to eat their dogs. And the sledges did not work particularly well. It was just too cold. It was too harsh. The machines were too primitive. They offloaded one. It was heavy. It broke right through the ice and sank.
We couldn't even keep our cars running in Montana in the 1950s. I can't imagine how they thought they'd do that.
Down the line, we may meet some motor sledges. Not when we talk about this, but on further explorations. Anyway, they get there a little late because they were trapped in sea ice for about 20 days. And he's worried by Amundsen, about Amundsen, because now every day counts. And here they are, they're trapped out on the ice. You can imagine the level of frustration. But they finally get in, and the trek begins on November 1st, 1911. So he's about, what is he? He's
couple weeks behind?
He's a couple weeks right behind Amundsen.
Yeah.
When he sets out. And they set out depots, of course, the same thing. They try the ponies. The ponies get a little inland. They, of course, die, and they have to feed them to the dogs. They're not comfortable with the dogs and the sledges. Their motorized sledges don't work. And they set out their depots as they go, not in a separate season, but in the same season. And so it's a big party that sets out. Some are depot setters, and Scott never says who he's going to take with him on the push to the pole, the final push. And they get up to the point where that decision has to be made. And he chooses four other people, which is a surprise, because the tent, the rations they packed, and everything was set up for a team of four, not a team of five. So they have one extra man with them. It's not explained why he went to five instead of four, but it obviously puts extra pressure on all of their supplies.
Yeah, if they're taking, absolutely.
If they're taking another 25%.
One can't help but wonder if by then the harshness of the journey led him to believe he might lose someone.
Who knows?
Yeah,
we
right,
don't know.
Exactly.
But he wanted a certain kind of representation on the trip, and the extra person that he took was an enlisted man. The others were all officers. So
interesting.
He had an enlisted man with him. Anyway, they push on to the pole. It's very hard because basically now they are what it's called man-hauling. In other words, they put themselves in the traces. They put the sled behind them. They're walking. They're not using ski. They don't know how. And they're just pulling this stuff uphill over crevasses, over these ridges that we talked about last time. But they get to the pole. And they get to the pole on January 17, 1912. So they get there a little more than a month after Amundsen got there, and they find his note and his tent. And Scott writes, "The worst has happened. All the daydreams must go. Great God, this is an awful place." And now all they have left in front of them is the long trip
home.
And their dream has been shattered. Their spirits could not have been
really different journeys. Yeah. Yeah. Not just in who got there first, but their experience of the same place.
Yeah. And as I say, pulling those sledges uphill, man-hauling, which they considered the sporting way to do it. None of this stuff about using animals or anything like that. We're men and we'll do it. And you have to remember that these were not trained, you know, athletes or anything. Okay. They were naval people who basically had not trained for this in any real way. I mean, in one sense, the fact that they even got there
shows what
tough guys they were and how resilient they were. Because
and part of the discipline of who they were.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, both was their downside, and it also what allowed them to get there. It was their challenge and their biggest success.
Yeah. Wow. So they head home, and the trip back is hell. The enlisted man dies on February 17th, so they're a month on their way home. His name was Edgar Evans. He has fallen several times and he's hurt himself. He just can't go on. And basically, when you say he dies, it's a combination of the cold, the unbelievable overwork, the strain, the starvation, because they're on starvation rations now. He's a big man and physically large, and he just dies. Then a month later, on March 16th, they've already been on the road, so to speak, for 2 months. And remember, Amundsen got back in 40 days. So now they're already out 60 days. Captain Lawrence Oakes, who was actually a captain in the Army, he wasn't a naval captain, and he was in charge of the ponies and other things, he simply walked out of the tent, and he says to Scott, this is recorded in Scott's diary, "I am just going outside and maybe sometime." And, of course, he never came back. So he, in effect, ended his own life to relieve the remaining three of the burden of his failing health and strength. And, of course, to give them a little extra food because all of them were on starvation. So now two are gone. Just 2 days later, the remaining three, Scott, of course, a man by the name of Dr. Wilson, who's a naturalist, also not a Navy man, actually, a naturalist, and left some wonderful, wonderful drawings, and a naval officer by the name of Bertie Bowers. They run into a terrible storm, and they make camp. So they set up their tent, but just a little tent, and they climb into it. They are 11 miles short of a depot, which is known as One Ton Depot. And basically, they're starving to death.
And do they know how close they are?
They know they're close.
Yeah.
But they can't make move. It. They can't get it.
What and keeps that tent there in a storm like that?
It's just tied down, and you can always cut ice blocks and put it around the fringe. Uh-huh. It's one of the things. But
man, what is it made out of that it doesn't just shred?
Well, it was made out of early canvas, and oiled. And in fact, probably on other sessions, other trips, we'll meet situations in which the tent blows away.
I know that. I mean, I keep wondering, or just shredding.
Yeah.
And it's so heavy. That is heavy.
Yeah. And so you're interested. Yeah. Because all of their gear, you know, was heavy.
Yeah.
It was very heavy. And of course, by this time, their clothing and their sleeping bags, because you actually perspire. And there's a terrible problem in staying hydrated because it's so dry. And you have to melt the snow. You can't eat the snow as it is. They sweat in their bags, and then, of course, the bags and their clothes, and then they freeze. So they're literally encased in ice, and there's no way to
tell. And 11 miles from
11 miles short of the depot. The final irony of that depot is that on the way out, that depot should have been set 30 miles, more than 30 miles from where it was, uphill. In other words,
they would have reached it. Yeah,
But it was
long
set
ago.
In the wrong, right? But it was set in the wrong place. And
did they not know that?
They knew it, but they just couldn't get it where it was supposed to be. Okay. And so they said, "Put it here." And so, if it had been where it should have been, they possibly would have survived. So there they are. They're holed up in their tent, and Sometime over the next 9 days, starving and freezing, they all died. It's not clear exactly when they died, although Scott's death is put at, I believe, March 29th. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, about 9 or 10 days after they set up camp. And Scott wrote in his diary a final entry. Now, this diary was found along with the bodies of the three men still in the tent, partially buried in blown snow, 8 months later, because the shore party had to winter over yet again before they could go out. It was so late in the year that they couldn't go out and look for them. So they had to wait till the next year. So 8 months later, at the beginning of the spring, it was found. And here's what Scott wrote. He wrote, this is his last entry in his diary. He wrote, "We took risks. We knew we took them. Things have come out against us, and therefore we have no cause for complaint, but bow to the will of Providence, determined still to do our best to the very last. Had we lived, I should have had a tale to tell of the hardihood, endurance, and courage of my companions, which would have stirred the heart of every Englishman. These rough notes and our dead bodies must tell the tale. But surely, surely, a great rich country like ours will see that those who are dependent on us are properly provided for."
Wow, that is really moving.
Yes, he was a beautiful writer.
And his diary... That's amazing. Yeah. And I mean, all the things he did wrong. And as he was leaving this life, he was so eloquent and forgiving.
Yes. And, of course, it's all there. Had we lived, I should have had a tale to tell of the hardihood, endurance, and courage of my companions, which would have stirred the heart of every Englishman.
Which he did in a paragraph.
Yeah, you can practically hear God Save the Queen.
Yeah, I know. I can't believe. Is this a really, this is just an amazing story. Yeah. And is it used, English children?
Oh, absolutely. I've asked
one
lots
of heroic
friends.
Journeys.
Yes, again and again. Well, when you were a kid in school, how was Scott's story told to you? And it has sort of the iconic position of George Washington crossing the Delaware and the cherry tree and things like that. Absolutely. Yeah. It stirs the heart to this day.
Yeah, it really
Englishman,
does. Even though I was very critical of the really stupidity of their planning, especially in contrast to Amundsen's planning. Yeah. And yet, in the end, the heroism of his kind of heart.
The dignity.
Yes.
That diary is on display in the British Museum. And Deborah and I were there a couple of years ago. Of course, it's written in pencil because you couldn't use ink in that climate.
Freeze.
So it's a little hard to read, but it's there. And when you know what the words are, you can see and think that, you know, that was pulled off of his dead body in that tent and brought back and eventually found its way.
That actually is one of the most heroic kind of and beautiful epitaphs I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. And one of the further ironies of this story, the combined story of the race to the pole, is that, of course, it's Scott who's remembered. It's not Amundsen. It's the loser who's achieved this kind of heroic place, whereas Amundsen was the guy who did it right and won.
Yeah.
But we're not excited by that.
Right. It was pretty matter of fact in a way.
Pretty matter of fact. Yeah. But we remember, of course, and certainly what's taught in England is the Scott story. Now, Scott had certain advantages. Number one, he wrote beautifully. And that's always an advantage if you want to leave a legacy, and particularly if you die.
Yeah.
And number two, the mistakes that he made, the things that he didn't do, are writ so large that the story has a kind of human interest riches. How could a guy like this, in one sense, be so dumb?
Exactly. The images of horses and hay.
That's right. And
anyone who's lifted a bale.
Yeah.
And you think, are you kidding me?
Yeah. So Scott lives on, at least in the popular Western imagination, as both a hero and an anti-hero.
Right.
A hero for what he did and the way he wrote about it, and an anti-hero for how mistaken he was.
How clumsily he moved forward.
Whereas Amundsen is, in one sense, a predecessor of the astronauts who, at least the ones that survived, who did everything right, and it was, in one sense, all in a day's work. Of course, it's not all in a day's work.
Exactly.
But we view it as all in a day's work, because he did it right.
That is really amazing, those journeys. Now, it occurred to me before we started this, when I think about these early explorers, particularly those in these harsh northern climates, do we have any contemporary parallels in terms of exploration? And because really the astronauts occurred to me, but there's so much technology and time and money behind them that's different.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because when we take a look at a couple of other Arctic, Antarctic trips, particularly the first attempts, now that the pole has been conquered, to cross, in other words, to get all the way across, to go to the pole up one side and then down to the sea or the ice shelf on the other side, we'll see they take place later, and the challenges are different because by now everything has been mapped from the air, so there are no huge surprises in that sense, and the technology has changed, and so adventurers, maybe they should be called as much adventurers as explorers, because in the strictly limited sense of explorer, they're not exploring anymore, they're adventuring.
Right.
And now the challenges have to be set in a different way. It's not discovery, it's the overcoming of obstacles. We have in a way, a parallel story with Mount Everest. After Mount Everest was climbed by Hillary and Tenzing in the 1950s, then other challenges about Everest arose and other mountains, a different route, a more difficult route up, climbing it, and this boggles the mind, without oxygen.
Right.
Because, of course, all the early climbers used oxygen, and most of the ones now. So these goals are set in some sense artificially to raise the ante, to make the achievement, if in fact you're successful, more astounding. And this is what happens in the Antarctic case as well. You get attempts not just to cross, but to cross first, to get to the pole and then cross unsupported. And unsupported means no depots. So everything that you eat or consume or use, you carry with
you. You bring it with you.
That's right. And this becomes an extraordinary challenge, only possible, I would say, with more modern
foods, lightweight
fuel, lightweight, etc. And this is letting a little bit of the cat out of the bag, but Antarctica has been crossed unsupported. And I think we'll probably put a few of those stories together at some point, because you're right. In one sense, what's just been the story that we've just told, I won't say it ends the age of exploration, of Antarctic exploration. It doesn't. But this is, in one sense, the high point.
Yes.
And then there's more exploration, and of course there's all kinds of scientific exploration. People are studying the bottom of icebergs and things like that.
But the drama of the first time.
The heroic age of exploration begins to wind down very quickly, and in fact, what I think we'll do next time, which is the Shackleton story, is, I would say, probably puts, if not the final chapter, certainly the penultimate chapter on Antarctic exploration, because what Shackleton set out to do was to cross. Now that the pole had been achieved, he wanted to cross. And
all the
way. I think we'll tell that story
next time.
It's a fascinating story.
Thank you so much, Richard, for this wonderful story. It's just, this makes me smile and warms my heart. I just loved hearing it, and I loved the setting up of the environment. That was really an important component to really grasping the meaning of the human aspect of surviving in that harsh climate.
When you think that how we experience, let's say, zero or sub-zero temperatures and how we prepare ourselves to spend some time outside in those kinds of temperatures. We'll knock that down to minus 40 with the wind blowing and you're hungry, et cetera, et cetera. It really is epic, the challenge.
It is epic. And once again, Richard Fagan, thank you so much for being with us today. And I look forward to more stories of Antarctica in February, our kind of the heart of our winter in some ways here. So good morning to you.
Thank you.